Right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Worksman's webinar for this afternoon. Very nice to have our panel on screen. I will introduce them in a short while. I see some of us are sitting in San Francisco, some of us are sitting here in Sandton, and others around the country, Cape Town, etc. So my name is Eric Levenstein. I'm head of the Worksman's Insolvency Business Rescue and Restructuring Practice Group. And we thought it would be a good idea to have a discussion this afternoon about where we are in South Africa, where we are globally in relation to the economy, the effect of COVID-19, and really to give some indication to all of you, the Worksman's clients, an idea of how we navigate crisis and what does it all mean for directors of companies that are facing very, very uncertain times. I don't want to use the word unprecedented too much because it's been overused, I think, for some time. So this weekend, history will be made when SpaceX, the company founded by our South African Elon Musk, in collaboration with NASA, will be launched hopefully over the weekend, and will be the first crewed commercial space flight, and will be the first spacecraft to take off from the United States for a period of nearly a decade. I was watching the aborted because of weather yesterday evening, and it really is an exciting event, something you should all have a look at over the weekend. But for Musk, this is an achievement of a lifetime and quite something when you think about where he's come from and when his capsule will be docking hopefully next week with International Space Station. It really is a truly remarkable achievement for him. And I was just thinking this morning, looking at a South African going into space, not him, but his spacecraft going into space. And here we are on Earth fighting a global crisis, and we have been for the last couple of months. And it really does kind of put things into perspective. The last time we faced a global pandemic, 500 million people, a third of the world's population at the time, were infected, and 50 million people lost their lives. So the 1918 Spanish flu was devastation and had a really bad toll on the human population. And roll forward to 2020, we all sit in our offices, some of us at home, obviously dealing with COVID-19 and the fallout. South Africa has not been unaffected. I looked at the numbers this morning. We have 25,937 cases at the moment, as of today, the 28th of May, and a death toll of 552. Predictions are that it's not going to get much better, and it's going to have a toll on the economy. And I think when you look around, the effect on the economy has been extraordinary. We've seen shuttered businesses, shuttered factories, empty skies, and empty roads. And the South African economy is clearly now slipping towards an economic recession. Large job losses are inevitable. The Gauteng Premier, David Makura, said that we can expect possible 2 million formal job losses in the next period, which is a substantial and frightening number. Government are going to relax the lockdown, as we all know, on Monday, the 1st of June, and we'll have to see what that means for business and for our economy. And there's no doubt that what we're seeing in practice as restructuring lawyers and insolvency lawyers is fallout. We've seen an increase in filing of business rescue across the board and have seen for the last couple of months. In fact, Dr. Rory Foller of SIPSI has confirmed there's been an increase in business rescue filing. SARS recently confirmed that there have been 144 companies filing for business rescue this year, when compared to just more than 200 for the full 12 months of last year. So you can just see the effect of what's been going on companies and the ability to continue to trade. Interestingly enough, there's been no reported from SIPSI, no reported liquidations, and that's only because the offices have been closed. So I think when they get their house in order, we'll see those numbers increasing. So today's webinar is all about unpacking what they call the new normal. What is it? How does management deal with what we term the new normal? And our panel will share their views and thoughts on these aspects as we go forward into the afternoon. So that's enough from me as an introduction. I'd like to just introduce my panel to you. We've got Nick Benadel, Professor Nick Benadel. He's a professor in the area of strategy. Afternoon, Nick. You there?
Hello. Hi, everybody. Hello, Eric.
He's at the Gordon Institute of Business Science of the University of Pretoria. Nick has been very involved in strategic leadership with particular focus on what he calls complex environments. And he's going to share with us this afternoon some of his thoughts as we go through the seminar this afternoon. I have Professor Andy Andrews. Good afternoon to you. Visiting professor at IESE Business School in Barcelona. Andy has acted as academic director and faculty member of the senior executive programs at MIT in Boston, and is a visiting professor running senior programs in Africa, Europe, Thailand, India, and China. He served as president of the Harvard Business School Club of South Africa from 1984 until 2008. So welcome to you, Andy. It's a pleasure to have you this afternoon on our panel. We have Stefan Smith, who is sitting in Cape Town, I believe. I believe it's very cold down there. But welcome, Stefan. Hopefully we'll keep you warm. Stefan's a partner at PwC and is a leader of the Sub-Saharan African Restructuring and Insolvency Practice. I've known Stefan for a long time, and he's been very involved in insolvency and restructuring workouts for some time. Stefan is particularly focused on ensuring the proper adoption of protocols for practitioners in the business rescue legislation, as is set out in Chapter 6 of the Companies Act. I then have Sean Collier. Sean is a director at Africa Special Opportunities Capital. He calls it ASOC Capital. With more than 20 years of private equity, M&A, and corporate finance experience, he's done restructuring, turnarounds, business rescues, managed wind downs, and distressed corporate investing. Sean's a CA, registered senior business rescue practitioner, and for his sins, is the one of the business rescue practitioners at Comair. And we're going to share some of his ideas and thoughts a bit later on. Nastasha Haduth, one of my co-directors at Worksmans, was admitted in 2010. She's been a director with me in our insolvency department for many years. She has got a wide-ranging experience in dispute resolution, litigation, and certainly restructuring and business rescue. Nastasha is also an Insol International Fellow, one of, I think, three or four in the country. So that's the introduction. I'm now going to, as an introduction to the topic, ask each one of our panelists just to give an overview, a broad helicopter view of how they see South Africa and the global economy at the present moment in time, and what their personal thoughts are. So I'm going to start with Nick. I'm going to keep you all to a 5-minute strict time limit. So off you go, Nick.
Thanks very much, Eric, and hi, everybody. Your reference to Elon Musk was interesting with SpaceX, but I always think about him in terms of his Tesla project, which really moved the logic of the US auto industry from Detroit to California over the space of 10 or more years. And in that sense, he managed to swing and shift the logic of this extraordinary auto industry that is a global phenomenon. This COVID phenomenon is very uncertain still, I think. We don't really know its medical implications. We're really grasping to understand its economic implications, its geopolitical implications, because it's really shaken everything up. I don't know how many people listening or watching have been to the cabinet war rooms in London. It was where Churchill led the cabinet underground. And it was locked up to right in the last, few days of the war, and only opened up some years ago. And I went early to look, and it was incredible to be in the room, which was where the cabinet, war cabinet, met every day, and see all the charts and maps, and then to see that they closed that reality off and then got on with the recovery. In some ways, we've left the world behind us, as they did there. And I would argue to some extent things won't quite be the same, certainly for the short and medium term. We won't get back to the way things were. And many of us can see either in our companies, industries, or in our personal lives that things have changed quite dramatically. Before the COVID-19 struck us, our economy was already in a very weak position. I don't know whether one could say it was critically weak, but it certainly was a growthless, aging stock of assets that was not innovating enough, and I would argue not broadly very competitive or fast moving. And the second big thing that we entered COVID with is the question of our structural nature of our economy, where poverty and inequality are the core feature of our overall economy. And what COVID has done is make that even worse. So we are in a pretty tough corner, I would argue, and hopefully we're going to use this crisis to make some significant progress, not just to get back into business, but to start shaping how this administration, which I'll come to in a minute, might shape the environment. My first reaction to all of this was what Alvin Toffler called future shock. It came so suddenly and so holistically that I have to admit that for a while I was pretty angry and also in denial. And for leaders, denial is not a good spot to be. Then we progressed through the adrenaline phase, made the adjustments, and now we're all grappling with a new normal. And the new normal, of course, depends very much on what sector you're in. Every industry structure has a different value chain and will be affected differently. For some, it will be fatal. For some, it will be very damaging. For some, maybe a glancing blow. And for some, maybe new opportunities are going to emerge as we move into this new digital world with a bit more speed than we have been up to now. What leaders are doing is to try and grapple with these realities, starting always, of course, with what's in front of us. And what's in front of us is two things. How do we reorganize the way we work and do business and get on top of operations where we can, and especially from the 1st of June? And secondly, more importantly, is what is the market going to do under these new conditions? How is consumer behavior going to change? Where are people going to want to spend their money, and where will they not spend their money? And if you think about airline prices, we'll hear about that maybe a bit later, is will airline prices go up or down as airlines try and get passengers to come to them? I think the whole demand supply curve is in disarray in most sectors. The next thing I want to briefly talk about before my time is up is to say, I think overall, businesses responded structurally to this challenge by working with government in an unprecedented way. I've been involved in some of those discussions and have to say that yes, some ministers are not doing as well as others, and you know, some of the regulations are sometimes incoherent, if not contradictory. But broadly speaking, the president framed the problem early and stuck to that broad strategy. And I think we're very fortunate. I just think every now and then of what life might have been like under President Zuma if he was still in charge of this country. I think President Ramaphosa has done quite a good job, and business is working hard with him to try and manage our way through this very, very complex times. And maybe we'll see some new pattern of relationships between business, government, and civil society, at least with a potential to emerge if leaders seize it well. So that's my opening remark, Eric. I think we're in a very challenging time. All of us need a map and a mirror to ask ourselves, why are we really in the room and what difference we're going to make as leaders, not just as managers? And secondly, the tricky part of figuring out the map that lies ahead that we're all going to have to master and walk down.
Thanks, Nick. Very interesting. Thank you. Andy, do you want to share some of your views with us? You're on mute, Andy.
How's that? Thanks, Eric. No, thank you. Hello to everybody. Look, I feel I'm masquerading here because I think I'm supposed to be an economist or something. I'm not. I'm a quasi-economist at the best of times, if I may say. My definition of an economist is a trained professional paid to guess wrongly about the economy. So my ideas about what's going to happen to the economy are probably pretty dangerous. But I think the big major factor here is that I think, as Nick said, some people are kind of shell-shocked, and the markets and customers and small businesses, perhaps even them as well, particularly, are really in trouble. And I was reminded of the quote by Ferdinand Foch, who's the field marshal in the First World War, when the German army was approaching Paris, and they were at the battle of at the Marne, reached the Marne River, and it was effectively all over. The French were shattered and completely in disarray. And he said to Field Marshal, one of the British Field Marshal Haig, who had been in South Africa, incidentally, in the Boer War, he said to him, "My center is giving way. My right is retreating. The situation is excellent. I attack." And I think that's the kind of attitude that I think South Africans are going to have to show, and the world for that matter, in order to come right. Because it's going to take courage and people bold and not shell-shocked to the point where they become unable to act. So I'm worried about the economy. I'm pretty negative about the future, actually, for the whole global situation, if you like. Because I think, in a way, I'm reminded of the sand pile economics, which I call Pierre Bock and a couple of colleagues formulated several years ago, about a sand pile if you drop grains of sand from a short height onto a table or a flat surface, it will eventually build into a pyramid, a cone-shaped shape. And as the pile grows, it becomes more and more unstable. And it's like an avalanche on the side of a mountain, basically. As it snows more and more and the snow gets thicker and heavier, it becomes dangerous. And the same thing's happening in the world today. And these guys study this. They were looking at avalanches and earthquakes and so on. There's fascinating studies that they've carried out in this area. And they said what happens is that there are fingers of instability that emerge into the sand pile. And as you drop these grains of sand onto the sand pile, they become more and more unstable. And eventually, you will drop just a single grain of sand onto the sand pile, and you can initiate a massive avalanche or even a small one. They don't know how to predict these things, because even earthquakes and so on, it's very unpredictable. But the smallest event can start a disaster. And I think the world we face these fingers of instability. I see them as political, humanitarian, worldwide inequality, as Nick was referring to, a medical crisis with the COVID-19, the social problems, economic problems, ideological, everywhere. And we see people tweeting and running, you know, major economies by using tweets, almost on the spur of the moment, reaction, seemingly not very well thought through. All over, we can see this uncertainty, and it would only take a small match to light a huge fire in the world. Somebody starts a war or an attack, because all over the world, we know about all the insecurity that's going on around us. So my worry is that, and as Nick referred to it, and I think it's a very important factor, is that management's attitude to this, the biggest problem is that very often it's top management's attitude and view and their beliefs are unexamined and not properly thought through. Their assumptions about how the world works are often very wrong and incorrect. And that goes for all leaders of all kinds, politicians and so on as well. And a whole lot of sacred cows that they're not prepared to question. And you know, John Maynard Keynes, who is the famous economist, he said, "Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influence are usually the slaves to some defunct economist." And we see that in some of the policies that have been in our own country, where we have this attitude, these assumptions, and these sacred cows that no one's prepared to question and to change. And so I think the world is a bit like, and I remember Nick in the old days was talking about white water, management in white water conditions, that it's very, very turbulent. It's always been pretty turbulent, but this is particularly bad. And it's a bit like, you remember the saying we used to use, it's a bit like playing Chinese baseball. You know, that while the ball is in the air, you can do anything. The bases can be moved and so on. And I think that's what's happened. All the bases have been moved. And because of that, there's this high uncertainty. And because of that, very few, well, I think most companies are not going to succeed. And so, you know, the problem is that As you mentioned, Eric, I was teaching a bit at MIT, and one of the guys there is a chap called Charlie Fine, and he talks about clock speeds. And you can see it, the small disruption at any stage of the supply chain. And he says every stage of most supply chains are moving and changing at different speeds. Some of them, right at the front end in cell phones and so on, are changing at nano speed. And while at the back end of it, the manufacturing of certain items and so on, all that come together to make a very complicated thing, are moving at very much slower speeds. And you've got to coordinate that. And any disruption to any one of those things, changing at different speeds and so on, facing different problems, is a huge problem. And so I think that, you know, we've got to understand what we do know and what we take for certain, and businesses have got to look at it very, very carefully as to what they're doing. There are some things that they understand, but there's lots of things they do not understand, almost a blind spot, if you like. And what they have to do very carefully is to go back to almost zero-based strategy. Remember the old zero-based budgeting? Start with a clean slate. Because as Nick referred to, the customers are going to be changing dramatically. Everything. They're going to, I think, the world we know, the corporates are now highly leveraged. Households are hugely stressed. And I think they'll have to examine every part of their business, from the products they sell, from the supply chains they use, the way they treat their people, the cultures that they've established, and whether they're appropriate, and who they listen to, basically. Because very often, most boards of directors have got a lot of groupthink, and they all think the same way, and they're not listening to all the voices. And some strategists are saying, really, you know, you've even got to really examine. For example, Clayton Christensen said that, you know, most companies are listening to their customers. He says that's a problem, because often the customer doesn't really know what they want. I mean, Henry Ford said, if I'd have asked the customer what they wanted, they would have asked for a faster horse. Now, the fact is that you've got to rethink it. You've got to look forward, almost starting into the future and planning backwards. And I think all we do in most companies are trying to think forwards, add 10% to last year's budget or whatever it might be. Now you've got to go right the way forward and plan it backwards. And that's the only way I think we're going to survive. But I think with that, I think let me hand over back to you, Eric. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. And I suppose what you really are saying, it's the mind shift. It's a mind shift, a pivoting for all Absolutely. Of us into this new normal, whatever that means. But let's hear from Stefan, what his views are.
Thanks, Eric. Hello, everybody. And I really wish Eric you'd let me go first, actually. It's very difficult to follow two such illustrious speakers. But I think, certainly from my perspective, I think I'm one of the unusual crowd like yourself that has chosen a career that is all about working with companies under pressure and stressed and distressed. So I think what I and the team are constantly reminding ourselves of is the things that we take for granted as methodologies for the companies we've been working with for the last 10 years is actually something that we need to evangelize, I think, a little now to sort of Andy's point about, you know, revisiting and re-examining and not accepting the status quo. And I think I do accept, I think we continually are underwhelmed when we meet a company in trouble about people's relaxed attitude or a feeling of stepping off and leaving it to someone else. Restructuring is the hard yards and it isn't for the faint hearted. And I think I often have described it as trying to service a car while the engine's still running. At best you might lose a finger and it could actually be worse if it goes wrong. It's a complicated space, but a little bit about, I've got the luxury of sitting on our global restructuring team and twice a month sitting and talking and hearing the trends. And some of the things I'm seeing, although we see ourselves very differently and rightfully so from a SA Inc. point of view, yes, we've been sitting there with low or no growth and we were already headed for a difficult 3 or 5 years to find our way out of the woods. And that can only be so much harder now. There are actually quite a lot of common themes that we're seeing emerging. And certainly globally, we're dubbing two types of company. One is the resets, which is those industries that know they'll come back. And their challenge really is forecasting and a range of forecasts to presume how it might come back, when it might come back, what level of demand, what pressure on profitability. But they will ostensibly be similar or the same businesses that need to refine themselves. Then you've got the change forever. And I think to the point of supply chains and customer selection, There are certain companies that are going to be absolutely changed from the core and will need to reinvent themselves at a speed of light, basically. So those two companies have different challenges, but nonetheless, they both have them to face. The other big observation is this is nothing like the global financial crisis that we saw in 2008. As a financial crisis and a liquidity-driven crisis, the likes of Lehman's actually, we see in the end, return something like 115 cents in the dollar to its creditors. So that is a matter of waiting it out. And I think here, with a pandemic and the level of disruption that we've got and the interconnectivity of how we trade and how we supply, the complexity of actually trading out through this one is one that is likely to hit us for much longer and take much more innovation to try and cure some of these challenges rather than just capital. But the interesting thing we're finding about capital is certainly, and Africa may be a bit more of a challenge in terms of foreign direct investment. But I think certainly if we look globally, we're now seeing that private equity funds and credit funds are sitting with 2 times the capital ready to deploy than they were in 2008. So I think there's a phenomenal likelihood of what we would call a deals-led recovery, lots of trading your way through this mass market consolidation, huge opportunism that might be invoked from this. And some of it will be just for the purposes of financial trading. So we're certainly seeing funds buying themselves into below par bonds and expecting them to bounce back very quickly. Even the equity markets, which took a knock about 30% globally, have already covered 50% of that. They've recovered already. So it's going to be a peculiar one compared to, I guess, what we all think we weathered as a storm in 2008. And also from a South African perspective, I think we fared reasonably well in 2008 compared to some others. At a micro level, and I think that's probably where I spend most of my time, I think is company by company. It really, really depends on each company and its circumstances. Our economists internally will give us a great outlook and give us a view of what the comeback is. But to you, it makes a difference. If you're ABC Pty Limited, your DNA, your ability to recover is not the same as the company next door or your competitor. So I think there are very idiosyncratic issues that are going to have to be dealt with on a company by company basis. And that begs the questions about how banks are going to interact with their customers on these things. Certainly, we saw an immediate rush of even companies with very healthy balance sheets rushing to their lenders, asking for additional facilities, purely as a buffer and as a caution. And that was very short-lived. I think some of them were successful in the first instance. But I think now we're seeing the mindset, certainly from lenders, starting to shift really to say, actually, given the unpredictability of this and the difficulty in forecasting or reforecasting the next 3 to 5 years, how can I enter into a financial restructuring on your existing facilities? I'm more inclined to give you a 6-month or a 12-month extension, help you and help me with going concern, and then take stock of it. So we think there's probably going to be a lag for somewhere around 6 to 12 months for informal balance sheet restructuring done behind closed doors between companies, their advisors and lenders. So I think that's going to be quite an interesting one. The gap will be filled with the hunt for liquidity, I think, quite simply. I think one of the things we're encouraging and I think needs to happen is self-help. I think we have to look at each company and see where within its own asset base and within its own capabilities, can it actually get some liquidity? And that can range from rapid cost reduction through to disposal of subsidiaries. And you might do that for one of two reasons. I mean, certainly we're seeing a lot of people taking stock and saying, look, if I've got 10 companies in the group and one of them is profoundly loss-making, I may no longer be able to have the luxury of keeping that one going in the hope that it'll be good on the other side. It might well be by actually just cutting the losses on that one, I give the chances of the other 9, a greater boost in terms of getting through all of this. So I think there's a lot of tough decisions to make. Yeah, it's difficult to make those in a hurry without regrets. So I think the boards are overwhelmed, I think, with the level of decision making that they'll be facing now that they've dealt with the early stage of stabilization. We do think there's probably going to be quite a large activity around distressed mergers and acquisitions. I think it's an obvious situation. I think those with stronger balance sheets might well be well poised to grab a bargain. I would suspect now would be the time that private equity is going to really pick its moments and deploy and find things at a heavy duty discount. And again, I think we're going to see quite a large scale consolidation in the market. Probably a massive uptick in business rescue. I think you've already noted, I think, Eric, that the numbers would reflect that that's likely to be the case. But I think let's remember, I think this might be a great time for us to evangelize the benefits of business rescue. I think it's had some really bad stigmatized areas. And sometimes it's been own goals by the industry where poor practices and poor execution has led to very poor results from rescues. But on the whole, it's designed to preserve value. And let's remember that liquidation is fundamentally value destructive in its own right. So I think it's really another focus that we need to get for people to realize rescue isn't the panacea for everything. Probably 80% of what we do is outside of rescue and behind closed doors. And there's good reason for that, because if you don't need the legal moratorium, rescue brings its own complexities. So it isn't necessarily the thing that you reach for in the first instance. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, I think we do need to remember that the legal entity needn't live on as long as the economic activity or the value in the business is extracted. Certainly most of the business rescues we run, we sell the business and assets rather than the company. So I think from that perspective, I think we need to embrace all the tools that we've got. We need to use the legislation to give us as much headwind as, or to take on the headwinds and see if we can actually save as many companies as possible. But I do think we have to be candid about businesses that just won't make it. I think we just don't have the depth of capital or the resources to restructure every company that's going to find itself in trouble.
Great, thanks, Stefan. I think your takeaways are this is not the global financial crisis of 2008. It's a completely different world. And what we're facing now is very different. And I think what you've mentioned is cash will be king. Strong balance sheets will probably translate into some good acquisitions potentially. We'll get back to that a bit later. And then I see you use the word evangelistic a few times, seeing that the churches and the synagogues and the mosques are opening next week. There's a very good theme there. So I like that. Right. Thanks, Stefan. Sean, your views.
Yes. Thanks, Eric. Good afternoon, everybody. And thanks for inviting me to this session, Eric. Look, one can only really build on what Nick, Andy and Stefan have talked about. And I think, you know, there has been elements and teasers of sort of doomsday thinking, but on the average, if you listen to all three speakers who preceded me, you know, there's still a good feeling of a bit of optimism. So I have a couple of sentiments and thoughts around what's already been shared already today, but probably might add a couple of things to embellish a little bit of that. So the first thing that is of a concern in this COVID scenario is the fact that this is uncharted territories for many boards, shareholders, lenders, management teams. A lot of them are more used to business as usual and perhaps the odd speed bump here or there. This is an environment that is definitely a very much a business unusual. And certainly the observation that we're seeing amongst those key stakeholder groups is a little bit of an unfamiliarity or a mobilization, just simply not knowing what to do. You know, as a executive manager of a business, you're faced with a significant complex trading environment where, you know, you're being restrained by lockdown regulations and other, on the one hand, on the other hand, you're being pressured by creditors and lender stakeholders. You're suddenly, you know, in a working environment where there simply isn't a rule book anymore to follow. And so we're seeing a lot of those types of situations in the projects that we are looking at and working in. And so I think one of the first things we do as business rescue practitioners, and more specifically as distressed private equity investors, which is where I deploy my personal capital into those types of situations, on a contrarian investment strategy, is to step in and give leadership, give people the sense of hope, to, you know, give them the leadership, help them understand and break down what the revised rule book is going to look like. And it's really through that firm and assertive leadership that one can really then begin to preserve value for the stakeholders of the business, for the employees, for the lenders, for the creditors, and for the shareholders. And so I think, you know, a real challenge in this market is the fact that many executives and management teams are simply working in an environment that is very, very unfamiliar and to which they have no toolkit to lean on. That's why it's relevant for the restructuring industry on this call today, on this webinar today, is that we've got to be working to assist to rescue those companies by giving them and helping them understand the tools, such as business rescue or otherwise. The second thing is, in building on the global financial crisis commentary theme, is this is unlike the global financial crisis, where it was perhaps sector specific. It largely hit the financial services industry, to some extent the insurances industry, and also obviously the real estate industry. This is an ecosystem problem. This COVID crisis affects everybody. It's an entire circle of challenges, and it all has a very much a domino effect. One has a knock-on effect to the next one in terms of industries, but also to stakeholders. And I had certain thoughts about this quite a bit. And my mind constantly wanders to those people who are then unfortunately the worst affected. And that is the employees, because that's where the last cent that's left in the till runs out for businesses that are in forms of distress. And so that's really where you've seen a substantial pain point in this particular COVID crisis, is that as companies rushed to conserve cash and to preserve their assets and to preserve their cash flows, the people who got hit the worst, the last, is the employee base. To some also lesser extent, the government, because you know, they're not receipting any taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, they have to then support the employees through some employment benefits. So I think my third point is very much around the idea that this is an ecosystem problem. It's not unique to any one particular industry. And to Stefan's point, some businesses will fare better than other businesses. Some will reset. And then my last and third point is around my further worry as it relates to this COVID crisis, and that there's going to be a permanency effect. There's going to be quite a permanent impact around where we're going to see the normal unemployment rates settle out at post-COVID. I think a significant amount of industry will simply exit the market. And the reason for that is that their equity on their balance sheet has just simply been wiped out. And they've got no means by which to reinvest, restart, and regrow their business. There will be a lot of M&A activity, and we are pleased to say we're getting a substantial amount of interest in raising our second special situations fund. We invested our first fund since 2016. But our second fund suddenly, through many of the DFIs, has garnered interest because they see the need for a secondaries investor with our skill set to deploy capital into distressed M&A scenarios. So we definitely believe there will be substantial pickup, and that's where the restart equity that will be required will come from, is through that M&A process. But for many, many, many small businesses, which is the backbone of South Africa's economy, the SMEs, their equity and savings are simply wiped out. And so how do you restart your business when you simply don't have any equity or savings to invest in? So I think that summarizes from my three viewpoints with respect to where do we find ourselves now. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Sean. So just 2 points. I think what you're talking about, there could be some form of consolidation, distressed M&A, for companies that have strong balance sheets and cash available. The question simply is, in what sector will they be investing? It might not be the airline sector. It might be others. It might be oil, gas. It might be Uber Eats. Maybe it's Netflix. Who knows? Maybe it's IT. But it's going to be interesting to see where people will be spending in the next couple of months going into 2021. Nastasha, directors are on a treadmill. They are confused, as we've heard from our panelists so far this afternoon. Just the legal rollout, the legal consequences of directors not taking the hard decisions early enough in a distressed situation. Just what are your views and obviously your own personal global views on where we are?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. As has been repeatedly mentioned, before the COVID-19 pandemic, South Africa already had weakening economy with high unemployment levels and poor socioeconomic conditions. Then came the pandemic, a national lockdown, a downgrade, reduced growth forecast by the IMF, and a report recently by the World Economic Forum advising us to expect a prolonged global recession. To get back to business, many companies are running spreadsheets to see how many people spaced 2 meters apart will fit in an office, planning one-way paths through the workplace and figuring out adaptations to restrooms, lunchrooms, and entrances. All of those are critical tasks, but they are not enough. The crisis has exposed weak points in our economy and businesses in general. We are only as strong as our most vulnerable citizens, and sometimes those citizens are in fact our national and business leaders. These deteriorating conditions will bring the governance of companies and businesses into sharp focus and will test the decision-making processes and resilience of companies to the very, very edge. What's needed is the ability to absorb uncertainty and incorporate lessons into a company's operating model quickly, very quickly. The mettle of boards and their directors will be tested during these trying times. Section 66 of the Companies Act provides that the business and affairs of a company must be managed by or under the direction of its board, which has the authority to exercise all of the powers and perform any of the functions of the company, except to the extent that the Companies Act or the company's memorandum of incorporation may provide otherwise. That is, a company's board of directors is ultimately responsible for guiding and managing the company. And as such, the body vested with the responsibility of ensuring that the company emerges from any crisis, including the current humanitarian and economic crisis. As we have seen from the judgment by the Gauteng Division of the High Court against Duduzile Mayeni, the former non-executive director and acting chairperson of the SAA board, directors are delinquent, a term more commonly used for juveniles who conduct themselves in an antisocial fashion. If directors have grossly abused the position of a director, taken personal advantage of information or opportunity that would otherwise accrue to the company, intentionally or by gross negligence inflicted harm upon the company, or acted in a manner that would have amounted to gross negligence, willful misconduct, or breach of trust, and where the director has acted on behalf of the company without the necessary authority to do so, allowed the company to conduct its business despite knowing that it was reckless, grossly negligent, or done with intent to defraud any person. Delinquent directors might also be held personally liable for the debts of the company under their supervision. Whilst other jurisdictions around the world, particularly Australia and New Zealand, have passed legislative measures aimed at shielding companies and their directors from the impacts of the pandemic by granting temporary immunity to directors from reckless trading for several months, South Africa has not done so. Therefore, although directors may be tempted in times of uncertainty to blindly forge ahead and abandon their duties and responsibilities as set out in the Companies Act, there may be serious consequences for those directors. And I think that is the takeaway that I would like to leave with all participants at the end of this session today.
Thanks, Nastasha. I think one thing that people don't realize is that the obligations of non-executive directors, as well as executive directors in South African laws, on a par. And it's not good enough to be a non-executive director and not make the hard decisions at board meetings. But we'll get back to some of that a bit later. Nick, can I ask you, thanks very much, all of you, for sharing those ideas. Nick, if you're a director in South Africa today, I mean, practically, you've now faced with coming back to work on the 1st of June. You've got all these constraints. Obviously, most of them would have been put in place in the workplace to protect your employees. I mean, how do you elevate yourself above what drags you down as a director or a manager? Just your views on that.
It's a very interesting question. Listening to the other panelists, I was thinking along those lines. You know, one of the South African traits, which is a good one very often, is we very sort of can do and operational. So we love to roll up our sleeves and get our fingers dirty and climb into the core of the business. And of course, as Natasha was just explaining, you've got to figure out PPE and social distancing, and they're very operational issues. So the trick is to get above that from time to time. It's not to ignore the operations. You must be the ability to step back a bit. And I would take the approach of maybe getting a small team, an element of your team, to think about, if we were entering this market or industry today, how would we do it? I worked with a big company years ago who had two divisions serving similar markets, and both markets disappeared very quickly, and almost disappeared. And the one CEO said, "Oh, guys, we've all got to tackle this. Let's get to it. Come up with your plans." And the other CEO said to his six or seven executives, two of you are going to stay behind and run this existing business, and the other five have got a year to create a new business. And it was extraordinary to see the difference. The one group all struggled on incrementally, and the other who held their feet to the fire. He said, if there is no business, you're out. They're the ones who responded strategically. So you've got to have enough time to reflect. You've got to have enough time to be operational, but you've got to step above the battle a bit and not get lost in the emotion of it. I think we haven't talked much about the emotional impact on leaders of dealing with this. You're literally seeing your world implode, many of the businesses. And to handle that is extremely difficult emotionally, psychologically. And you've got to have the guts to confront the reality. And two last things. You should restructure the business. And by that, I don't mean the divisional portfolio. Who's going to do what as we re-enter and restart up and restructure that? And secondly, you've got to make sure that your information flow is very, very lively. And the best way for it to be lively is to get into the point of delivery, the point of use, and the point of action. I'll say one last thing. Crises do always create new opportunities. And what all leaders should be doing is reaching out to previous customers, potential customers, and new customers, and start new relationships. Because the whole shaking up of this process allows you, in a way, under very difficult circumstances, to take a fresh canvas and paint a new picture.
Nick, just on that, when you look at the younger employees in organizations or younger management as opposed to older management, do you think there's a distinction there? I think I said to you when we spoke the other day, we used to call them millennials. What are we going to call the people that survived COVID?
I'm not sure. But let me share with you a thought about this age difference. It's not just about chronological age. Mandela was an extraordinary 75-year-old. And I've met many 25-year-olds whose minds are like concrete. It's more just the attitude. And that's why I give a lot of credit to the president for framing the problem and the grand strategy of an early lockdown as effectively as he did. So there is a generational difference. The younger generation may be more open-minded. I certainly have found the digital divide to be huge and I've tried to close it. But it's much tougher, because what happens is memory gets in the way of vision. And so as we mature, we tend to be more and more certain about our assumptions. And what very significant change does is break the assumptions. And let's call them younger mindsets, not necessarily age-wise younger. But the fertile mind, that's why I was referring to Elon Musk, his fertile mind developed a new concept of a motor vehicle. And he had the ability to impose that imagination on the world. And I think that's what we need. We need that energy. And then the point that somebody made about supporting people, I think, is very, very important. We know very little about how to manage a team virtually. We're now going to start getting back to some proper interaction. But you've got to make sure you are supporting your people, your top people especially, who are probably equally adrift and uncertain. You've got to give them, as someone said, some hope and direction. Otherwise, you're not really a leader.
Thanks, Nick. Andy, your views on that topic, pivoting, morphing into the new normal, what advice would you give directors, management, in the situation of opening up next week into our level three? You're on mute, by the way.
I think that going into that, they're going to have to almost, make sure that they offer stable base, basically. Stabilize the present, if you want to call it, and preserve the present. You know, as Nick was saying, I think you've got to look at those customers that are critical to you, to your business. Who are your best customers, for example? That kind of idea where, you know, who are the profitable, they may not be the profitable ones, the ones bringing in the cash flow may not be the biggest customers, but they're the ones who are large enough and pay you on time and so on. And make sure you can preserve it in that particular way. The second thing is to also, because cash flow is going to be the critical thing in these early stages as you go back into business. Because the demand on your people, I mean, as a young chap where I'm staying at the moment, I'm in a thatched place, that's a house at St. Francis Bay. And we got a little bit of a leak, as you can often get. And he was almost in tears today. He said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've got three teams of people thatching and building, fixing roofs and so on. And he says, if one of my guys gets sick, the police tell me they're going to close me down. Because like stores, there's the Pick and Pay, I think, in Jeffreys Bay had one ill staff member, and they closed the whole place down. And so he says, if that happens, and he says, I've got nothing. I don't know how I'm going to make it. And he says, all of my people, my 15, 18 people that he's got, we're going to lose out. So he's got to protect that, get that business going, and protecting it from a cash flow point of view. And he's got to make sure that the key role of his people, he looks after those people, because they are also the average worker out there in most businesses is taking much more strain than the executives, in a sense. You know, they're living in crowded conditions, very awkward positions. So I think they've got to start doing those things, looking after the people and their customers. And then, of course, get back into the planning process, getting back into this budgeting process, the scenarios, if you like, of, you know, what's the worst case scenario, what would happen. And so they get a real feel for the impact that the changes are actually going to make on them. And that's a vital part of it. And then start thinking about longer term. Perhaps, you know, maybe you need three horizons, basically. You know, perhaps the first 3 months, 6 months, and then a year. And perhaps after that, you know, some really big innovations, if you can really do them. But I think that's the survival. This is survival mode for the small businesses and for most businesses. Even some of the big businesses that I was thinking about, you mentioned, you know, I think it was Sean is involved with, is it Comair, you know, that's a difficult. Sun International, the tourism industry is absolutely shattered. You know, what's going to happen to Sun International and those kind of businesses? Cement, construction, Afrisam and PPC Cement, these businesses, what do they do under these circumstances? Lots of them have got lots of debt. Cell C and the telecom businesses, they got lots of problems with Blue Label. Those companies they've got to start making sure they can keep those businesses afloat in this time, in the short term. So I think that's the big challenge that they're going to face. 3 months, six to nine months perhaps, and then perhaps a little bit longer.
Great. And the Q&A box is open, and there are lots of questions flooding in. I've got one here for Nick. Quickly, Nick, from Melanie Brink. She says, for Nick, do you still regard supply and demand as a business model relevant to where we find ourselves now? And I mean, it's all about creating value in what she terms transformative business models. And I mean, is that something from your perspective, from a strategic perspective, that people should consider?
Well, the danger of talking about supply and demand is that it sounds too fundamental. But I think it's exactly what will happen, is the shape of those curves have shifted. If you think about, as Andy and others were talking about, how you conserve cash. So companies change their expenditure pattern, industrial companies to each other and industrial to consumer and so on. Consumers will change their behavior. Partly they'll drift into more digital. Partly they'll want to protect themselves. Partly they've got to take the burden on of supporting more people, as we see. So I think the demand supply curves is exactly the place to start. You first got to ask, how will consumer behavior change or customer behavior change in my market? And then you've got to work out how the demand and supply are going to intersect. That's why I use the example of the airlines. Will we find airlines discount in order to get volume, or do, because of the extra costs, they have to then actually make a premium price to keep the business afloat? Those are tough dilemmas. And the battle will move quite quickly, as Andy was very helpfully saying. There's a 30-day battle of back to work, get things going. There's a maybe a 9-month battle of saying, okay, this first phase we've survived, we've got going again. And now how do we develop a competitive edge as the market shakes its way out? And some of our competitors may drop away or really struggle, M&A opportunities, and then a longer term view. But the battle will keep moving. You know, Napoleon used to have a lovely quote. He used to say that every battle has its own personality. So I think the fundamentals of how demand and supply come together by sector is going to be very, very interesting as older companies or slower companies, more traditional companies just can't move fast enough. And let me say one last thing. Most of this has to do with the mindset of the leader. It's extraordinary to me in these times we're in, I'm not talking about COVID times, but the times we're in, that an individual will frame the debate, will frame what's happening, will ask questions and bring information. And very often they hold the fate of the business in their hands. I'm talking even of very big businesses. So individual personal leadership is going to be absolutely key in interpreting quickly the changing nature of the market and competitive behavior.
Thanks, Nick. We're going to get back to some of those questions if you've got time. Stefan, you know, one of the big things, and Sean, I would like to hear his view as well after you've dealt with this question, and that is, you know, companies go through this mindset of rabbit in the headlight. They don't know what to do. The board can't really see the wood for the trees. Yes, they're financially distressed, but maybe they'll be bought out. Maybe the shareholder will put in money. And off we go. We kick the can down the road and we try to do what we call an informal restructuring, as opposed to the formal business rescue. Now, I know we've debated this, Stefan, over the years, but just in relation to this new dispensation we face now, what are you seeing when clients come to you and say, well, should we just continue doing our best in an informal situation, or should we buy the moratorium by filing for business rescue?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting thing, Eric. I think the dynamic has actually changed very quickly for me. I think we've historically seen quite a binary mindset to business rescue, which is either people have a very bad feeling about it or an aversion to it. And it's a question of carrying on and doing what you did before and hoping that the next final attempt to raise some capital or solve the problem is there. And literally running these companies until the tank is empty and then handing it over for a business rescue with, I suppose, partially a sort of self-interest of, I no longer need to take responsibility for this and the practitioner takes over in substitution for the board. Now, we've always defended against that and said, look, the reality is firstly, anything you may or may not have done has already occurred. So if you think you're avoiding a director's liability as a result of filing, it's a poor motivation for rescue. Secondly, there's a very good reason the Companies Act has got a 6-month test of forward-looking liquidity. is that you don't give somebody a business with no fuel in the tank and expect them suddenly to raise post-commencement finance out of nowhere. What I think we're seeing now actually is a lot more discussions about what are my options. And it's spurned a very different debate that has allowed us to say, well, rescue is one of the options, but if it's a subsidiary, have you thought about a solvent winding down? And even if you had to chip in some group cash to make sure you could make it a solvent winding down, the reputational risk that you might avoid by a collapse of a business rescue, or in fact, a cross default from your lending, makes that a much more sophisticated solution. And I think one of the challenges obviously around business rescue is there's no concept of group rescues, which in of itself has probably caused practitioners like Sean and myself no end of pain in deciding whether one puts the whole group in or puts certain entities in, and how do you deal with the web of connectivity between those businesses, whether that's intercompany loans and the whole variety around that. So I think undoubtedly we're going to see a larger volume of business rescues, and rightfully so. I think the million-dollar question is, do you need a moratorium? The biggest thing afforded to you in a business rescue is the moratorium to keep creditors at bay. The logic there is you only really need that where you have a large volume of creditors that you can't control. So if you've kept the business going on a shoestring, you've got hundreds of trade creditors in arrears, probably the only safe way will be a business rescue, because you just sooner or later somebody is going to file a liquidation application. Conversely, if this is a debate between the equity holders and the senior debt holders as to who should put the next money in and who gets what terms in, those kinds of things should continue to go on behind closed doors. Rescue can be a very clunky and a very expensive process for solving that kind. So it's very much a horses for courses, I think, Eric. I don't think that's changed, but the sheer volume of rescues undoubtedly will change.
Thanks, Stefan. Sean, just to answer that question, informal versus formal, and also the importance of keeping management and the board intact when you take on a business rescue filing, how important is that? And obviously, it's something which if you release the expertise of the company and you're coming into a business cold, it makes the job so much more difficult. So what are your views on informal versus formal and the importance of keeping directors and management intact?
Thanks, Eric. I'm actually going to break my answer into two parts. And one is in the ordinary course, to answer the question, informal versus formal, and under the current dispensation. I'm going to deal with the current dispensation first, and that being under the regime of COVID-19, the lockdown and the restrictions that go with that. And I think one of the things that really accelerated a formal process, or is accelerating formal processes in under the current dispensation of COVID-19, is the fact that very few companies have sufficient liquidity to trade for any length of duration without necessarily being able to generate some, any, or a big proportion of their revenue stream. And so I think when that dynamic shifted, and the inability to see a way forward to continue to generate revenue, at least to buy yourself time during a informal process, that was rapidly accelerated as a consequence of lockdown in the COVID scenario. And the reason I answer the question in that manner, and definitely in the current circumstances, I think more appropriately business rescue is suited in the COVID type situation, because liquidity dries up so quickly. You may end up having a business that does have a commercially and a technically solvent balance sheet, but it simply runs out of liquidity. Now, in the ordinary course, I've said for a long time, and it was interesting the premise on which we raised our first ASOC fund to invest in South Africa as a special situations fund. It was actually targeted originally to provide post-commencement funding in a formal business rescue environment. That was what it was designed as. It was modeled very much along the lines of what exists in the US around DIP financing or debtor in possession financing. It was under that basis that we engaged with investors, et cetera. As things unfolded and we examined various investment opportunities, it became clear to us that actually investing into existing business rescue situations is to use Richard's, Stefan's words, Richard's my partner, sorry, Stefan's words, is that it's a clunky and expensive process. And unfortunately, the use of our capital as an investor oftentimes goes towards funding that clunkiness and that expensive process. And so as a consequence in our fund, we actually didn't invest in any business rescue investments. We preferred to do an informal workout. An informal workout is far more consensual. One preserves elements of the business's value far better. It's much more cooperative process. That participation is important to keep the franchise value of the business intact, because a business rescue process is very confrontational. There are a lot of people who have very divergent interests, and they immediately race to their corner to protect their corner, when you know the real value actually sits in the middle of the mat, and that's where you should get people to come to. And so it comes back to what we see as a critical part of our success in our investing activities, but also in our advisory activities, which is where we are participating on the Comair matter. It's about leadership. It's about stepping into the center of the ring and saying to everybody, guys, if we don't work together consensually in this, it's not going to work. And everybody's just going to end up with their little corner of the mat, which is a value destructive in the whole. So in the current dispensation, I think we have no other choice because of the liquidity constraint to use business rescue tool, and it is useful as a moratorium. But I think if it can be avoided, that is sort of where we lean as a business. Thank you, Eric.
Sean, and maybe to everybody, you know, I was in Beijing at a conference some years ago, and we were speaking to Chinese investors looking at some targets in Africa and South Africa, and they were saying, where's the list of distressed assets? Can I please get the list and hand it out to them, because they're keen to come in and buy. Now, someone's asked the question, you know, are South Africa's business rescue opportunities marketed in some way to state sovereign wealth fund managers and other investors? Is this not a big opportunity for South African companies in distress? And again, we get back to cash is king, strong balance sheets, opportunities. Now, you know, we're going through a rough time. Is there a silver lining in respect of 1 + 1 = 6? Whoever wants to answer that question can. Anyone want to put up their hands?
If I may.
Oh, sorry, Sean and then Stefan. Yes.
I want to talk about lists. When I was a junior analyst in New York, working for a distressed private equity fund and being the junior kippie at the firm, my job on a Monday morning was to go onto the internet and go to every single bankruptcy court filing in the United States and download all of the bankruptcy filings, because typically most companies file for bankruptcy on a Sunday night or early on a Monday morning before the equivalent of the SENS announcements opened. And so that list that we downloaded was effectively a to-do list for the week, as we would sort through which opportunities we would want to have a look at. Now, it's really unfortunate in South Africa that is not the case. And when we hung out our shingle and raised our first private equity fund to focus on investing in business rescue, the three of us partners sat and stared at our phone for about 3 or 4 weeks waiting for it to ring, and it didn't. And so the fact that there isn't a better system to help inform prospective investors that there is opportunities to invest in this kind of space is a bit unfortunate. So the way we solved it is we did the good old shoe leather trick, which is we then got in our car and drove to all the banks, attorneys, accountants, et cetera, and started, you know, canvassing for transactions that way. And so I think to Mr. Fabio's question, I think that it would be useful to have a list, and And perhaps there is an association of which you might be familiar with, Eric, that maybe that might be able to assist in trying to get some of this information together, because it would be valuable for the investment community.
Sure. In fact, international markets have something called DebtWire. There's the corporate watch list. We don't have that in South Africa, and it would be a very useful feature, I think, of opportunities for distressed buying up of debt. Stefan, your view?
Yeah, I think, interestingly, Eric, I think there is a list. I think it's just an informal list. And I think back to Sean's point about the shoe leather, I think is if it's a fairly small club of restructuring folk in the country. And I think, you know, if you've got your network going, it's fairly clear where there are opportunities. Certainly from an internal perspective, we run it across our the wider part of our business on the corporate finance and the distress side, which is we link in with the intelligence that's out there. I mean, we're spending a lot of time with private equity for various reasons. We're spending a lot of time with lenders around non-performing loans. There are constant conversations going on with law firms like your good selves about what's going on. And I think the informality of that is that there is an idea of where those issues are. And some of it's very much, as Andy said, in the public domain. I mean, I think, you know, the challenges of CELC have been some 3 years in the making. You know, Edcon's 3 or 4 rounds of restructuring have been anything other than sort of, you know, public in their entirety. And I think so. I think it's probably more a question about appetite and where the capital is coming from, because I think from a foreign direct investment perspective, I think we are, to Nastasha's point, presenting quite an unattractive environment right here, right now, for foreign capital. And therefore, it becomes a question of where if the dry powder I referred to that exists in Europe and the UK, why is that not all coming here? There's probably good reason, is because there's country risk that just diminishes what they see as the potential yield of the distressed investments. I think where we're seeing probably more chances of actually getting in capital to change things is where somebody has a mandate and it's transformative capital. And I think that's coming particularly from the international and the local development finance institutes. So I think in that context, I think they have a much, much larger remit and mandate to be able to think longer, think 10 years where someone else is thinking 5 years in terms of the payback on a project, because it creates employment or because it creates an economic benefit above and beyond the investment that they make. So I think it's a bit of a tough call. I think, Sean, you probably could count on one finger that I suppose the amount of times you could drag some cash in directly from the US. I think they're more likely to put it in a fund like Sean's or another fund like it and say, actually, you've got a better view of the lie of the land and we deploy to you and you deploy onwards. But direct investment that way from a sovereign wealth fund, I think, is probably a tall order at the moment.
Right. Can we move on to another topic, Nastasha, and that is directors' personal liability? You know, the fear factor is what brings a lot of clients through the doors of law firms, of boards who are worried about personal liability. Now, I want you just to explain to all of us, Section 22.1 is all about reckless trading. What is it all about? And as we've seen in international jurisdictions, there's been some leeway given to directors in the COVID-19 trading cycle not to be prosecuted for reckless trading. We've not seen that in South Africa. There's been no amendments to our legislation at this point, which is interesting. But SIPC did try alleviate that position. Perhaps you can just unpack that for us quickly.
Yeah, Eric, so the CIPC issued a practice note 1 of 2020, which essentially provides that the CIPC will not invoke its powers under the Companies Act to issue compliance notices to companies that are temporarily insolvent and still carrying on business or trading, provided that the insolvency is due to business rescue conditions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. This leniency will lapse, according to the practice note, 60 days after the declaration of the national disaster is lifted. The practice note does not, however, suspend, amend, or override the provisions of the Companies Act. And the fact that the CIPC will not exercise its powers under Section 22, which deals with reckless trading of the Companies Act, does not absolve companies from and their boards, particularly from the requirements of the Companies Act, nor does it deprive persons who have suffered a loss as a result of the director's conduct, or rather misconduct in these circumstances, from their rights to proceed against those directors, as we have already discussed. Now, Section 22 of the Companies Act specifically provides that a company may not act recklessly, and all courts have interpreted recklessness to act and or trade under insolvent conditions, or to have a complete disregard for the company's interests. Section 77(3) of the Companies Act says that directors who allow a company to act recklessly can be held personally liable. So what the CIPC notice did is suspend its powers to issue compliance notices to companies, but it certainly has not suspended the duty, or rather the liabilities of directors that they may incur if they allow a company to trade recklessly.
So there's no defense to be raised by anybody who's sued one day for trading recklessly in insolvent circumstances, not being able to pay your debts, to say, well, look, you gave us a holiday, therefore we are able to defend that position. So that's a very important aspect. Nastasia, because you're the only lawyer on the panel, Fausto De Palma has asked a very interesting question, and it's one all of us can think about, and that is, do we think that the judiciary is going to take a more lenient view in relation to companies that are going through financial distress, as opposed to the lenders and the bankers that might want to enforce their security or their loan positions against companies that are not paying? In the context of liquidation versus business rescue, just what are your views on whether you think the judiciary is going to be more lenient in the months to come?
Yeah. So, Eric, we moved from a creditor-focused regime where we only had liquidation to a debtor-focused regime where we have business rescue. And I think we are moving towards a stakeholder approach, where it's not just the shareholders and the creditors, but also the employees who are important consideration for our courts. So I think our courts will have to weigh up the pros and cons of holding companies liable. But it's interesting because if a creditor applies for a company's liquidation, the court may, out of its own volition, decide to place the company into business rescue instead. We haven't seen that being done yet. There's certainly no case or precedent on that part, but I think it's something to look out for as a result of the pandemic. And I think that we do have a more stakeholder company focused approach in South Africa at the moment.
Okay. I'm going to ask each of you to wrap up. It's getting darker in Sandton, in my office even more darker because my lights have gone, because I'm not moving around enough. I'm going to ask Sean to start, just a takeaway from the session this afternoon, which I found most enlightening and very interesting. So I want to thank all of you in advance. But Sean, just a two-minute takeaway, kind of closing view.
Thanks, Eric. Great. And thanks for inviting me onto the panel. It's been a pleasure to talk today. My view is, I think, just thematically in the current environment we find ourselves in, I think that the favorable disposition towards a more formal process should be encouraged. I think it should continue to evolve the way it's evolving. But my longer term view always is that an informal restructuring is more beneficial, more consensual, and more value retaining than an informal. And I think that, you know, using the right tools at the right time to do the right job is what's really actually appropriate in situations like this. And I think the success of anything is around understanding how best to preserve. That includes human capital value, the importance of saving jobs and people employed, greater ecosystem is very important. And for that, that requires strong, firm, decisive leadership. Often it's not a popularity contest. And sometimes you've got to make some decisions that are going to be unpopular with various stakeholder groups. But it's more important that a firm decision be made and you stick with your plan. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Sean. Nastasha, your final thoughts for the afternoon while it's getting dark. You're on mute.
Sorry. I think that for me, business is a risk for reward, a game. And I think that our legislation has built in the business judgment rule, which allows directors to apply themselves in a way that is for the benefit of the company. I don't think that our legislature has gone far enough to protect directors in trying times. And because of that, even though it might be business unusual, as Sean liked to say, directors need to be keenly aware of their duties and responsibilities under the Companies Act, because in that part of the world, nothing has changed and they can still be held liable. And that would be my takeaway for this panel discussion.
Thank you. Stefan.
Thanks, Eric. I think it's a call to action. I think it's we must draw something positive out of this. And I think from my perspective, we must make the most of it, which is can we use some of this as part of the industrial re-engineering that we so desperately need as a country? I think we need to stop focusing on preserving sunset industries when we actually have a great opportunity to reinvent the next 10, 20 years of what South Africa can be famous for. And I see so many examples of innovation and where we really lead the way. Things like fintech just amaze me in terms of the way we outpunch our weight globally in terms of some of that innovation. So, I mean, I think it's a massive opportunity to really rethink rather than this kind of business as usual. And I think we must accept that consolidation will take place. And I think we must accept that certain things are going to fall by the wayside, but we must spend our time and our 80% of our effort on the things that will get us through this and rebuild the economy. So, I think it really is time for boards to be truly responsible and think whether or not whether this is a business that can make it through, or whether or not the capital and the effort could be redeployed into something that could be far more productive for the next 5 years.
Thank you. Andy, your final thoughts.
Thanks, Eric. Well, it's been fascinating listening to everybody talking about this. But I'm going to go back to the micro side of it, if I may, because I think that the business people who are actually running businesses out there who are, facing the having to get out of the trench every day and run at the machine gun type of thing, they're the guys who I really feel sorry for. And I think just some ideas, I think the first thing is you've got to get your team together and you've got to be completely transparent. You've got to show people what the numbers are, what the situation is that we actually face. For example, many businesses are operating on razor-thin margins, and it's vitally important that they protect those margins. You know, I think that's why this kind of budget, this zero-based budget or plan, basically, has got to say, look, if our sales go down 10%, our profit could be wiped out. We could have zero here. Because lots of firms are quite, high operational leverage, we would call it, basically. But they've got to understand that, and everybody has got to understand how important it is and what the situation is that facing the company. And therefore, the leader also has to listen, because we know the power of diverse opinions. Get everybody on side. It's not a case of, a couple of people at the top making the decisions and deciding what we do. I think it needs to be a big team effort. And we know that, all the research is showing that you've got to have this view, this diverse view. I remember the example of, the Enigma, when they cracked the Enigma code and so on at the Bletchley Hall or whatever it was called. you know, they had to crack the code. They didn't only have mathematicians like Turing and guys. They had philosophers and historians and people who were good at crossword puzzles and all kinds of people, backgrounds, working on it in order to understand, approach the problem of cracking these codes, which Churchill said, Nick referred to Churchill's war rooms as, you know, one of the most important achievements of the war was to crack those codes. So you've got to get this diversity of opinion in and make it a team effort. And so it's, you know, ensure revenue stability, make sure the cost people understand why you're cutting costs, share the pain with your suppliers, tell them that you pay a little bit of the money, can come to agreement. If you're a good customer, they want to keep you afloat. You've got to identify clearly, everybody must understand the critical process, the actions. This is the priority, the critical success factors or survival factors, you might want to call them. And then you've got to have empathy and understand that the people are going through hell out there. Everybody, I think, is lots and lots of people are very nervous. They've got mortgages to pay or they've got expenses and kids at school and they're not sure where this thing is going. So I think, as Nick referred to earlier, this is a time for really great leadership. That leadership is going to be challenged in this particular time, in the next year or two, maybe longer.
Thanks, Andy. Nick, I've left you for the last word, as they say.
Thanks very much, Eric, and thanks for inviting us all. You know, I was just thinking about, as this conversation went along, that the technology of this conversation exactly represents the new normal. We would never have done this 3 months ago. We would have had an auditorium and take a lot of time to get there. Instead, we've been able to interact live in real time. It's been fantastic. This is part of the new normal. And we'll all adjust. I'm an optimist about South Africans. I think back to the 80s and the impossibility of resolving our political problems. And yet we did. And 5 years later, there was Nelson Mandela, the most admired man in the 20th century. We've got some kind of DNA that's a frontier resilience. I indulge myself. I don't know what you're doing with the spare time that you've got, but I'm trying to read as broadly as I can because that stirs the imagination. And last night I indulged myself by rewatching the 1994 Rugby World Cup final. And I haven't watched it for years. 95. Yeah, I hadn't watched it for years. And watching it last night from end to end was just incredible. And to see Stransky kick that drop, and I was out of my chair with excitement. It was 25 years ago. Then what I did is I watched a 25-minute documentary on FAF and the final in Japan. And it was a fantastic documentary showing how his tactical presence on the field and how courageously he played just changed, and we blitzed those English. It was an extraordinary thing to watch. So I think we're a resilient country. I think new people will step forward. Let's look for the mavericks and let's step into the wind. Let's not shrink and get too fearful. All change is successfully managed if you step in to the nature of the problem. So I've enjoyed taking part, and thanks very much for inviting me.
Thank you, Nick.
Eric, can I just say, if I may, on Nick's point there, you know, it's really quite interesting that there's a quote by T.B. Macaulay, I think in 1830, he was talking about this, and he said, on what principle is it that when we have nothing but improvement behind us, that we now expect nothing but deterioration before us? And, you know, it is possible that we will come out of this and it will be hopefully successful. And maybe this whole process will cleanse the country of some of the nonsense that's been going on, and we can really get on and talking about building a really great nation like they did in 95. And you might remember my nephew played in that game, Nick, 95. So it's a special memory for me as well. I also love watching it again and again. So
thank you, Andy. I'm going to wrap it and leave it there. I just wanted to just some concluding remarks before we wrap it up. I want to thank everyone for participating. I think the takeaways for this afternoon is really about being resilient. And as Nick says, South Africans generally are. I think companies need to use the opportunity to look at their companies in a very hard and rational manner and in a realistic fashion. If it requires downsizing, if it requires retrenchment, if it requires something out of the ordinary, that's what they've got to do. I think directors have to be nimble, think out of the box, and bring along the company and all its employees with that thinking. And it comes back, I think, again, to what Nick said, it's all about leadership. So we're going to leave it there. I want to thank everybody, Nick, Andy, Stefan, Sean, and Nastasha. I want to thank Nolu, who has been very quiet at the bottom of our screens, looking after us and for organizing this webinar for Worksmans. I wish you all well, and hopefully we'll see you all soon in person and not over Zoom. So I wish you a good evening, and thanks very much for participating. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Thank you.